I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Baltimore police say that the murder late last year of a Harford County engineer, Jacqueline Smith, was not, as her husband, Keith Smith, claimed, committed by two panhandlers. Instead, Smith and his daughter are charged with the crime. The actor Jussie Smollett is facing felony charges for claiming that he was the victim of a violent attack in Chicago, an attack police say he staged himself. Amid complaints of fake news and widespread distrust of police and public institutions, who can we believe? Initially, we empathized with Smith and Smollett, and did our empathy actually get in the way of our making rational judgments? On this installment of Midday Culture Connections, we'll talk about it with Dr. Sherry Parks right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks to everybody who has stepped up so far in our spring membership drive. We are very, very grateful for that support and grateful that you're tuning in to listen to another edition of Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. She's the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. She's a scholar of popular culture and the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. She's also the host of Beyond on the Ballot here on WIPR, which airs twice a month on Thursday afternoons during All Things Consider. And she joins us on the first Tuesday of the month to talk about all things cultural. Good to see you, Sherry.
Good to see you.
And listeners, if you'd like to join our conversation today, we're going to talk about the Jacqueline Smith murder case. We're going to talk about Jussie Smollett. And we're going to talk about, of all things, empathy and how empathy might, in some weird way, actually get in the way of our making rational judgments when we hear news stories like that of Keith Smith, who claimed that Jacqueline Smith, his wife, was killed by two panhandlers. And police now say that that's not at all the case. So to join us here on Midday, our number is different than the number you call to pledge your support to WIPR. Our number to talk on the radio with Dr. Sherry Parks, 410-662-8780. You can also send us an email, midday@wipr.org. And you can drop us a tweet as well, @MiddayWIPR. So, Sherry, let's take the Smith case and the Smollett case sort of one at a time, and,
okay,
and let me get your take on both of these. So we have, in the case of Keith Smith, 52 years old, his daughter Valeria Smith, 28 years old, they have now been charged by police with murdering Mr. Smith's wife, Jacqueline, who's 54 years old. This happened in December, and his original story was that they had been approached by panhandlers. Mrs. Smith gave the woman, there was a couple, a woman and a man, gave the woman some money. She appeared to be holding a baby. And the man, according to Keith Smith, at the time is alleged to have stabbed Mrs. Smith right in the car and stolen her purse and run away. The police are saying now that's not the case, that Mr. Smith and his daughter, Valeria, were apprehended in Texas, apparently intending to flee the country and go to Mexico. What do you make of all of this?
Well, evidently, I mean, one of the first things we heard about Jacqueline Smith is that she was a very kind woman, so that giving money to a panhandler would be something that she might do. So immediately she becomes a very attractive victim. So which is interesting because she's African American, and often African American female victims don't get a lot of empathy that we're going to talk about later. But she was built up and characterized by friends and family as someone who was always helping someone. So we came to like her. And of course, the image of Baltimore in the conversation since has centered around the image of Baltimore as a dangerous place, even though panhandlers have not dealt much in the mythology of Baltimore being dangerous. And so that idea of, and it became a national story. It wasn't just a local crime. So here was this kind woman, which is a trope, the kind woman doing something that people in cities often do, and then that becomes dangerous. And the report was that panhandlers had a rougher time after that. Now, I mean, this is us falling into a narrative of this kind woman being victimized by somebody. And even though at the time, like when you heard the story, did you think about the logistics of how it would be difficult to stab someone in a car and grab the purse at the same time?
I did. I question that, although I will say that in this case, it seemed because Mr. Smith, who I saw a little bit on television and whose reporting about I read pretty extensively, seemed very sympathetic to me. I was very empathetic with Mr. Smith, less so Mr. Smollett in Chicago. Mr. Smollett's case raised some red flags for me from the very beginning. But Mr. Smith seemed incredibly believable because, as you say, the behavior of giving money to people who are asking for it on the street seemed in concert with Mrs. Smith's character, mm-hmm. and even his. He calls himself a minister, as well as the fact that we do have a very violent city and in many respects and in many neighborhoods. And so it was believable that this heinous act of cruelty and violence and trickery could happen. It seemed plausible to me.
It seemed plausible, and yet, I mean, the statistics are that women are vastly more likely to be victimized by somebody they know.
Yeah.
And somebody close to them. And so, but that didn't even come into the, but the idea of the grieving husband is something that we know as well. Even though how many cases, we won't sit here and count them, when somebody said that a stranger did it and the husband or boyfriend, or a wife or girlfriend, but more often the husband or boyfriend did it. But because this is a much more interesting story, I mean, when we hear these stories, we feel, and we're going to talk about that in more depth in a bit, but that feeling of a good woman and a dangerous stranger is much more interesting than the good woman who married a bad man.
Mm-hmm.
That's a little too close.
Because mm-hmm. there are some things that, you know, now have been brought up, and perhaps you were hip enough to think of them earlier than I did. But first of all, this is an area that's pretty isolated. On the east side, Chase Street Valley, there's a sort of abandoned park near that intersection. The question is, why would anybody who really wanted to succeed at panhandling be panhandling there? I mean, it's not Martin Luther King Boulevard where there's cars coming back and forth all the time.
The logic of panhandling.
The logic of panhandling. So why were there panhandlers at 12:30 at night, in a very cold night, in a pretty quiet, abandoned neighborhood? But it's possible that they were.
It's possible.
They were walking down the street, they see a car, and they, you know, stick up a sign.
Well, and
all
and,
of it's plausible. How about you? What was your first reaction? Do you remember? I mean, did Mr. Smith seem, and his daughter seem credible to you initially?
Well, it's interesting because I did focus more on her and her story and how that was terrible. I didn't focus on the husband very much. I mean, I have to admit, I didn't spend much emotion on the husband either. It was more on, oh, you know, she was an electrical engineer at Aberdeen, upstanding, loved by all, evidently. And so it was that that I focused on. And so he, as, you know, if, and I don't mean to be flip about this, is if this were the film, he'd be the supporting character. And well, now he's the star of the sequel. But the idea that a good woman being good and then was killed because it was something that I did empathize with. It was interesting that the closer you got to the story physically, the neighbors said they questioned it immediately, that not only is it an isolated area, that it's even more isolated after a certain time of day. And it was after that time of day.
And no one recognized panhandlers that fit the description.
Right, you know.
A very specific description. I mean, Mr. Smith described the man as a medium-skinned black man with a hoodie, with a goatee. I mean, it was even that kind of stereotypical rendering of the mm-hmm. criminal.
Even the goatee.
Goatee. And it added, the other layer of this to me was, this is a woman from Harford County.
Mm-hmm.
She was not from the east side of Baltimore. So it plays into this trope, I guess you might call it, from people in suburban communities distrusting the safety and the security of Baltimore City. We've got the Carroll County School Board after the unrest in 2015 disallowing field trips to places like the aquarium and the science center.
They've come back.
Yeah, they have.
but you're right.
But you know, but there's that whole thing, you know, the suburban notion of what happens, quote unquote, downtown. And I, you know, I hear that from people who live in the suburbs who really do fear coming to the city of Baltimore.
Who don't.
Yeah, and they don't because of it. They live their lives out there. And it's by no means a vast majority of people I know who happen to live out of the city. So, but there's all these narratives then. There's all these assumptions or things that again, just appear plausible. Every part of it in a lot of ways did appear plausible. But then, as you say, when you start looking at it closely, how do you stab someone and take their purse in the open window? And why didn't the guy drive away?
And the husband was in the car.
And the husband is in the car.
So I mean, this is the way mythology works. I mean, popular culture picks up on the mythology, and these familiar stories are believable in part because they are familiar.
Let's listen to a clip of Keith Smith. This is following the murder of his wife. It begins with his daughter, Valeria. Again, she's 28 years old. She was the stepdaughter of Mrs. Smith, who was killed. This is a meeting they had with the press soon after the incident.
It happened right up the street from my house. And the girl, she just came and she was like, she had a sign and she was asking for help because she had a baby. And I was in the back seat, so I wasn't really paying anything any mind until I seen someone actually approach the car. And then that's when, you know, it just all just happened so fast. And now she's gone.
It was something that, it was horrific for something like that to happen. But I'm right now just absorbing all of it. You know, absorbing in all of it and trying to see how I can move past this. But I'm not going to move past this until I talk to whoever my congressman is about banning panhandling. Because now from this tragedy with my wife, I don't even look at panhandlers the same way. I look at them as a threat to my life now. So that's what I'm going to push for. And I'm going to make it in my wife's name, Jacqueline Smith. She didn't die in vain. She didn't die in vain. I'm going to make sure she didn't.
And so knowing what we now know, knowing that the police have extradited Mr. Smith and his daughter from Texas to stand trial or face charges here in Maryland, it's easy to listen to that and say, oh, there's all sorts of holes in that.
Well, and they've also been charged with conspiracy. And the more listening to that, I begin to build the case for conspiracy. And I mean, because they not only told a story, this is a constructed story with a political campaign attached to it.
A political campaign in what way?
He's going to talk to his representative about a bill.
Yeah, he's going to have legislation.
Right.
And the proximity to the death in that press conference was very short. So it's interesting that all of a sudden it seems to me that if, God forbid, anything happened to my wife, the last thing in front of me in a car, the last thing I'd be thinking about is, you know, legislation 4 days later. Mm-hmm. I'd be rolled up in a fetal position. On my living room floor. And I said, that's interesting. We have to take a little break, but when we come back, we'll get to our caller, Charles in Owings Mills, and we'll talk more about this case, the Jesse Smollett case, and the fascinating role of empathy, which, Sherry, you hit me to in an article that is an interesting and somewhat counterintuitive take on how empathy plays into our judgments in cases like this. Dr. Sherry Parks is with me here in Studio A. I'm Tom Hall. It is the Midday Culture Connections Day on Midday. But first, we want to pause for a few minutes to talk about the importance of our members to the work that we do here at WIP. Thanks, Andy, and thanks again to everybody who has made a contribution in this, our spring membership drive. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on Midday, Eating and Drinking Locally. Al Spohler, the host of Cellar Notes and Radio Kitchen here on WIPR, joins me, along with Regina McCarthy. She's the author of Maryland Wine, A Full-Bodied History. We're going to talk about the very vibrant Maryland wine industry. Plus, we'll be joined by Sharon Stowers, Harford Community College's first scholar in residence, and we'll talk about options for local wines to go with our locally sourced dinners. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. She's the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art and the host of Beyond the Ballot, which airs every other Thursday afternoon during All Things Considered here on your public radio. Our phone number is different than the phone number you use to pledge your support to WIPR. The Midday phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. Sherry, let's go to the phones. Let's go to Cockeysville. Owings Mills. Charles, welcome to Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Yeah, hi. So the comment that I would like to make is regarding this kind of knee-jerk reaction that people sometimes have to these sorts of stories, where they look at it and say, you know, people reporting these sorts of stories that sound wild, we can't believe them, we can't take them seriously. And the point that I would like to make about that is, you know, when an attack like this happens and it does turn out to be true, well, what do? You investigate it and you figure out who did it. You find the truth. And if it turns out not to be true, you do the same thing. You investigate it. You figure out that it, in fact, wasn't true. And the only way you figure that out is by investigating it. So the point that I would like to make is this sort of thing proves that you need to take these stories seriously at all times, or else, you know, you don't take it seriously and you don't look into it, you don't figure out what actually happened.
Okay, well, thanks for that comment. I mean, when it comes to the Me Too movement or to any of these situations, there is an instinct, an impulse on the part of many folks to believe the victim. Believe the woman is what we heard. You know, hashtag believe the woman. We heard that during the Kavanaugh hearings. That's not a bad impulse to have, is it?
Well, but historically it wasn't the impulse. I mean, blaming the victim for centuries was the issue. Why was she there? What were they doing, et cetera? Did she lead him on? And so Believe the Victim has been a campaign to recognize, and the data says is that people don't go through the trouble usually of reporting something that didn't happen, because it's not a pleasant thing. But I mean, what gets in the way of the believing the victim or disbelieving the victim is long before that person has their day in court, not the preliminary date. The media in a case like this has built a case one way or the other. And in this case, the case was built against the missing panhandler person and focusing on the virtue of the victim. And the husband was almost a non-play. You were asking about his emotion. The one thing that caught my attention is that were I man or woman, the spouse, and my spouse had been robbed and stabbed while I'm sitting in the next seat, whether I could have done something or not, I would have been racked with guilt.
Yeah.
I mean, I think...
Why didn't I save her?
Yeah. Why didn't I get out of the car? Why didn't, you know, what happened? There were no 911 tapes or any of those things we've gotten used to doing.
Well, he did have a conversation with the 911 operator.
Oh, did?
And he
okay.
patted himself on the back, actually. He said that the 911 operator said it was a good thing that I didn't get out of the car and chase them, because then I could have become a victim too.
Okay, so
he made it a point to say that, which I thought was also a little...
But when you have still been racked with guilt?
Absolutely.
No matter what?
Absolutely.
Isn't that an automatic response? And so he's giving his excuse, and that did catch my attention.
I mean, if I were in Phoenix and something happened to a family member in Baltimore, right. I'd be racked with guilt.
Right.
I mean,
right.
you know, if
right.
I were
exactly.
on a business trip or something.
Right.
It just,
right.
You know,
what could I have done?
What could I have done? Absolutely. Let's go back to the phones to Karen in Baltimore. Karen, welcome to Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. So I've lived and worked in the city for a long, long time, and I also take a lot of public transportation. And I always carry a little bit of small change and or some food if I'm going down to work. I work at Hopkins, I'll bring extra sandwiches and stuff. And so when the story broke, a lot of friends of mine and acquaintances said, see, you shouldn't help people out. And I said, well, you know, I'm not going to change my ways, because my experience was that I've never had a bad experience with panhandler. They're always, you know, grateful mm-hmm. for it. care I can give them.
Okay, Karen. Well, thank you for that call. I'm going to let you go because the phone connection is really terrible, and it's difficult to make out everything you're saying. But this is Karen saying that, you know, a lot of people, and you alluded to this in the first part of the show, Sherry, after this happened, a lot of people were, you know, locking their doors and rolling up their windows and not even considering making a donation to the many people who were panhandling in many, many corners of and intersections in the city. And homeless people were reporting that, you know, donations were down. And that seemed to also be a sort of natural reaction.
Well, and first let me say, I wish we had a structural solution so that panhandling was not a necessity. I'll say that in my little soapbox first. But we said this early on, there's a logic to panhandling. It's not a good thing to commit crimes because that has the result that it had. It just doesn't make sense. But I think it is something that people could do. That if your fear is crime in general, this is something that you could do rather than feeling incompetent in the face of it. So there's an emotion there too.
Let's listen to a tape of Jesse Smollett. He's the actor who appears on that very popular show called Empire. And most folks know the story by now. He alleges that he was accosted by two guys in Chicago wearing Make America Great hats. And they had a noose that they put around his neck after they accosted him. This is what he had to say to Robin Roberts on ABC.
I respect too much the people who I am now one of those people who have been attacked in any way. I was talking to a friend and I said, I just want them to find them. And she said, sweetie, they're not gonna find them. And that just made me so angry because, so I'm just gonna be left here with this? You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm just gonna be left here with like, so they get to go free and go about their life and possibly attack someone else, and I'm here to left with the aftermath of this bull. That's not okay. So I understand how difficult it will be to find them, but I still want to believe with everything that has happened that there's something called justice. Because if I stop believing that, then what's it all for?
Thank you, Jesse.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, if I stop believing that, what's it all for? You know, he's an actor. It turns out to be his profession. Very easy to empathize with this, although Karen, our caller, whom we couldn't hear very well, and others have made all sorts of points about the details of that story right from the get-go seemed a little strange. But let's talk about this notion of empathy. If one does empathize with that, who's crying on, you know, morning television, you turned me on to an article about a guy from Yale, a psychologist, who says that empathy can get in the way of rational judgments and moral decisions. This is a guy, what's his name here? Paul Bloom. Explain his argument. This is fascinating to me.
Well, and I said something earlier. Think about when we first hear these stories, we have an emotion, and that emotion of we can imagine being in that car, or we can imagine walking down the street. We've sat in cars, we've walked down streets. Empathy is not feeling sorry for the victim. Empathy is feeling with the victim. We put ourselves in that, and you can have what most people, because we're social beings, so unless you're a sociopath, you are feeling with the victim and putting yourself in their place, and therefore having, you know, we don't necessarily act rationally in situations of danger unless it's well practiced. And so it overrides the rational thought as we follow the case. It's really important because we are feeling with each other. So there aren't a lot of times where we act as a country, and it used to, they're all mediated at this point, but we don't use the Super Bowl so much anymore. That audience is fractured. When we come together and feel together, it's moments like this, and we reaffirm that we are part of a community and that these emotions matter. That's a whole lot of emotion, right?
Yeah.
And we're getting these stories not once. We're getting, I mean, how many times did you hear some part of the Jesse Smollett case?
Absolutely.
Right.
It was all, it was the story for a while. And it sort of snuck up to be the story. But pretty soon thereafter, the story became, there might be some holes in it.
Yeah, but even those people, I mean, think of, look at the motion after we found out it was, I mean, look at the anger to the Smith husband. But look at the Smollett anger of, I felt betrayed. I wasted some of my emotion on him. And find out that this was all orchestrated, or I guess at this point we still say allegedly orchestrated, but the court of media opinion has closed this case in a way. That means that I felt with you like I would a friend, and then I got lied to, and there's this feeling of betrayal because it can override the facts. Emotion can override the facts, and emotion can last longer than the facts, way longer.
Yeah. And it's interesting, the media role in this, as I looked at the particularly the print media and the job that the folks at the Baltimore Sun did about the Smith case, I find no fault whatsoever with the media at any step along the way. They reported what was being said by officials. Gary Tuggle is the guy who stood out there on that field next to where this where the murder occurred, and said there's a woman wearing a brown overcoat with certain kind of buttons, and a man, you know, with a goatee and a hoodie and all that stuff. The police at that juncture had believed Keith Smith's version of events to be true. They trusted the verisimilitude of what he was saying, and they then said to the public, "We want your help finding these two people," and the Sun and others reported that. I just don't think that in the media played any role in this at all. In a way,
it's important that your example is print media, and the print media tend to state in the facts. That doesn't mean that there's not a lot of television that feeds the emotion, telling the story over and over, that we know in a way feeds the emotion, mm-hmm. too. So, but notice.
Yeah, and I'll admit, I didn't watch any of the local TV coverage about it. Although Jane Miller from WBAL was certainly looking into it, and she had some of the most insightful observations about it in the last 48 hours in her tweets and I assume in her reporting, which I haven't had a chance to look at.
But notice in your example, the print media speaks to the rational part of our cognition.
Mm-hmm. We got to take a little break. We'll come back in just a second. Dr. Sherry Parks of the Maryland Institute College of Art, her latest book is called Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. We will have more of this month's installment of Midday Culture Connections when we come back. But first, let's send it over to WYPR's program director, Andy Beanstock, to remind you that it's important that you make a commitment to your public radio. And thank you, Andy, again. Thanks to everybody who has made a pledge in this, our spring membership drive. We really appreciate it. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday today. It's the Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks of the Maryland Institute College of Art. We're talking about believability and credibility and empathy and how they inform our decisions when we hear stories like that of Keith Smith, who's now being charged with the murder of his wife, Jacqueline Smith, or Jesse Smollett, the actor in Chicago, who apparently has staged an attack on him that was a racist and a hate crime. Police now saying that, in fact, he was the one who hired two guys to stage that attack. Our number on Midday, different from the number you call to make a pledge, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can send us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. So, Sherry, you wanted to follow up on a point that we talked about before the break.
Well, I just wanted to point out that empathy is the tribal emotion. I mean, that it is how we form a tribe. And if you think about that, it's meant to override the rationality. It's how we take care of each other. You're a parent, I'm a parent. Are there things that if our child were in danger that we would do that didn't make sense in terms of our own survival? That tribal emotion is what's really, really important. The fear response that we were talking about in terms of panhandling, that there's a lot of data that suggests that some people will lean in, like Karen, and some people will lean out, like her friends. So that fear response and empathy co-occur, and the person's history and context will respond to that. It's really interesting if you look at the empathy research about the power of stories. And in fact, all of the empathy research is really narrative studies, because you can't shock people and then see what happens. You give them a story. So all of it is really story data. So we know that stories can and you can measure empathy. I mean, the hormonal levels and it's left in the blood. There are lots of reasons in self-report. We know that stories can provoke empathy. And so that feeling that a story can provoke is well documented and lasts over time.
Chris, people do make so-called rational or intellectual decisions about, for example, whether or not to give money to a panhandler. Kevin Lindemood, who runs healthcare for the homeless, says, you have other options, and that maybe giving money to an actual person on the street isn't the best way to help that person on the street. I know in my own life, I'm reluctant to give people money. But at the farmer's market or in front of a restaurant or something like that, I'll buy the person lunch. I'll buy the person food. I'll say, when's the last time you ate? And I will believe, if they seem believable, that, I haven't had anything to eat all day, or, I'm hungry. Well, come on over and I'll buy you a sandwich. And that seems to me somehow better than giving the person $2.
And that's a well thought out conclusion. But let me ask, when the person is standing by your car, even though you've given money to charities, I actually do much the same thing, don't you still feel the tug?
Oh, absolutely. Because you see these folks and they're disheveled and they seem cold and they're miserable and it's just awful and you want to help them, but it is a very conflicting thing.
I have to remind myself that I am donating.
Yeah. And on the other side of this, here we have we have Jesse Smollett or Keith Smith, people that we definitely believe to a certain extent initially. And then we're asked now to believe the police, who are saying, nope, that didn't happen. Whereas the first time the police came out here in Baltimore, Interim Commissioner Tuggle said, this guy's testimony seems credible. Therefore, we'd like your help in finding these people. And now the police have changed their story because they've looked into it further, which is their job. And we want to get to the truth. Why should we believe the police? I mean, Chicago and Baltimore, there's all sorts of problems with credibility in the police department.
Well, and it's interesting because in both cases, the police had to race the public opinion. They actually act on the public's feeling. We've got to solve this crime because the people are. But in both cases, and the Jesse Smollett actually talks about the friend who says they're not going to find him. What she didn't say is that the clearance rate of the Chicago police is abysmally low. So yes, so why should we believe the police because of their stature, of their supposed stature, or the day-to-day experience? It's a very complicated idea. In Baltimore and Chicago, the police will tell you they have a credibility problem.
And I will say that as a white guy, I am inclined to believe the police. I am inclined to believe that the investigation initially showed that Mr. Smith, his story was credible, and that further investigation, like the fact that he moved out of his house just a little more than a month after this happened, seemed to be going out of town. The police followed him. They found that he was in Texas. Then they found he was close to the Mexican border. That, according to Interim Commissioner Harrison, said that those were things that were red flags to them. Yeah. And they say, well, he appears to be going to Mexico. And then they obviously have much other evidence. I mean, it seems to me they would not have made the statements they've made so far unless they had other things. And we don't know what that evidence is now. And we may never know it. Or, perhaps it'll come out. I'm sure it'll come out if there is a trial. Let's go to Marco in Columbia. Marco, welcome to Midday. You want to talk about Mayor Pugh and an announcement that you were one of many who were a little bit surprised by.
Yes, just wondering if, a public official like that, an elected official, should be making a comment presuming that Keith Smith is guilty. And, that raises all sorts of legal difficulties in terms of the trial when that comes up. And I'm sort of surprised that I haven't seen comments about that in the media.
I agree. And, you know, at this press conference with Interim Commissioner Harrison, not only was Mayor Pugh there, but Marilyn Mosby was there as well, the state's attorney. And they both seemed very confident that Keith Smith is the assailant in this instance. And they have said so. They've said so outright, or at least the mayor has.
Well, remember that in a way, Baltimore was also on trial. I'm thinking this through and thinking that, given the statements they made, that they responded to that, that Baltimore became the perpetrator in a way, and pushing back against the fear of Baltimore was part of the message.
John McWhorter wrote a piece in The Atlantic about the racial aspect of the Jesse Smollett case. This was came up before the Keith Smith case came to light. And he said that racial politics today have become a kind of religion in which whites grapple with the original sin of privilege. Converts tar questioners of the orthodoxy as problematic blasphemers, and everyone looks forward to a judgment day when America comes to terms with race. What is the racial component on these two things?
Well, first of all, I mean, to add to that point, racism has become the new evil. That people have commented that's the worst thing you can say about somebody. I mean, it's pretty bad, but I mean, there are lots of other things that are pretty bad. And both of them play on racial tropes of, you know, when Jesse Smollett, who is a light-skinned African-American gay, he says, this is a quote that was next to the quote, "It feels if I had been a Muslim or a Mexican or someone black, I feel like the doubters would have supported me much more." So he's trying to push himself into the victim part and to argue away some of the stereotypes that would have spoken against. So both of these are conversations about race, but they're kind of, I don't believe there is a post-racial moment, but you can argue that here the female victim is a black woman. Here the male victim is a gay black man. And so the victimhood is not the Southern trope of the ideal white woman and the black monster. But in both cases, the monster stays black.
Yeah. And a woman named Catherine Russell Brown wrote a book called The Color of Crime, and she studied 92 cases that ended up being hoaxes, right? So here we have, in these two instances, the hoaxers both being African-American men. She writes approximately two-thirds of hoax perpetrators are white. So once again, African-American guys are in the minority. They right. don't do most of the hoaxes. I mean, this is a white thing by and large, and has been for quite a while.
Well, and Jesse Smollett, in a way, makes that because he's got wealth and privilege. If you think about as hoaxes go, you'd have to not be under tight surveillance in order to do this.
We have to be cognizant of history. We have to take that into consideration when we make any kind of moral judgment, whether or not it's being clouded by our impulse for empathy. A woman named Anna North writes in Vox last week that the phrase and a broader version "believe survivors" are reactions to a long history in which women and others who reported sexual misconduct were dismissed, smeared, shamed, or ignored. That's a true thing. Mm-hmm. And so it has to inform in some way how we think when we hear, people coming forth about Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, for example.
Yes, I mean,
it wasn't just one person.
That outpouring of, well, you know, me, another type of Me Too. That they didn't believe me. They didn't believe me. And as several of your writers have suggested, this calls for a reasoned response. The emotion, which is well-meaning, in a way gets in the way of a longer, well-reasoned response to this, is that sometimes people are innocent and sometimes they're guilty.
Jim emails, he says, "To me, the most heinous part of the alleged Smollett hoax is that potentially Smollett would have allowed a pair of strangers to be falsely arrested, interrogated, and perhaps even convicted just to reinforce his story." Obviously, he hoped that they would never be found, I guess, that was part of the plan, if in fact the plan, as Chicago police have alleged, turns out to be true. And, Mr. Smith knew that they were never going to find these two people because they didn't exist.
I suspect Jesse Smollett did not expect the FBI to become involved, and they did, and that was part of it.
So it's just one of those things that just got out of control too fast. He was not a, he had, of course, prior to this, sent himself a piece of hate mail, I guess, to the set of Empire. We have 30 seconds. Somebody wrote a piece about the Me Too movement and the necessity to talk about predatory white women. I mean, this goes back to Emmett Till, you know, with white women being part of the problem of placing blame on black men, you know, without cause.
In order to support the image of themselves as innocent.
Yeah, yeah. Well, fascinating stuff. Difficult stuff, as always. That's the kind of stuff we mess with when you show up. And it's good to see you, and we'll see you next time. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Dr. Sherry Parks. She's the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. She joins me for the Midday Culture Connections every month. She's also the host of Beyond the Ballot here on WIPR. That airs twice a month on Thursday afternoons during All Things Considered. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared has been recognized by the Daily Media. You can find menu and hours at joesquared.com. Coming up tomorrow, Maryland Wines and Area Farms make it possible to drink and eat locally. Al Spoler and the wine expert Regina McCarthy join me, along with Dr. Sharon Stowers. She's the scholar in residence at Harford Community College. Coming up right now, another opportunity for us to remind you that this is our spring membership campaign. We want to thank everybody who has stepped up so far and become a member of WIPR.